Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
But I will remind you of those things. I will remind you that I said that Dodger fans better not act like they've got this whole thing wrapped up based on one single game. And I will also remind you that yesterday I reminded you all that something like this did happen in the NLCS when the Dodgers broke out in Game 3. And then everybody here in this town with a Dodger license plate frame thought they were going to roll from that point on. But then they got hammered in Game 4. I would remind you of that, but not say, I told you so. Screw it. I told you so. I told you all yesterday this is exactly what could happen, and did. And you didn't have to wait very long for it to happen. Brandon Lau was the second batter of the game. Now, this guy had come in having gone 6 of 56 in the postseason. His manager had said that he, quote, looks like Elf on a Shelf. Except Elf on a Shelf just left the yard and he went oppo.
Swing and a drive hit towards left center field, giving chase to Taylor all the way back to the wall. It's gone! A first inning homer for Brandon Lau. 1-0 Rays.
That ball got small in a hurry.
Rays radio. Man, that was huge. Not only because it signaled that Lau could be breaking out and getting right, but it proved that the Rays were not going away. Like, they didn't come all that way to get punched in the face 4 times and just turn around and go back home. The Rays made it 3-0 in the third, and then Lau came right back again in the fifth.
Swing and a fly ball, well hit into left field. Going back is Taylor, all the way back towards the wall. It's gone! A 2-run homer for Brandon Lau, his second of the night, and the Rays have a 5-0 lead.
Rapo taco, if you will, for Brandon Lau. Standing the baseball again, and just add that one extra biscuit for breakfast this time.
Did dude just say oppo taco and an extra biscuit for breakfast? Damn, that Elf on the Shelf can rake. And he can take you deep the opposite way, i.e. oppo taco. 5-0 Rays. Did anybody really think the Rays were just happy to be there? Just happy to reach the World Series? That just reaching the World Series would be good enough and they'd be cool with getting their asses kicked once they got there? I mean, if you thought that, you don't know these guys. When Lau is hitting and Joey Wendell is hitting, suddenly this Rays lineup looks a lot different. Suddenly it's not just Randy or Rosarena. It's not just his show. Suddenly they start to string things together and innings get longer. And then there's that pitching. If you had any doubts about that, Blake Snell put those doubts and the Dodgers' bats to bed in a hurry. Remember how explosive that Dodger offense was in Game 1? Yeah, well, it was not there at all in Game 2, thanks to Snell. He had a no-hitter working through 4 2/3. He struck out 9 along the way. And then by the time he actually did give up a hit, which was a 2-run bomb to Chris Taylor, it didn't matter. Not really, not at that point. After that homer and a walk and a single, Cash did not waste any time in coming to get Snell and turning that game over to the bullpen. And the bullpen was doing work. 4 1/3 innings, 3 hits, no walks. The only damage came in the form of a couple of solo home runs. But when you've got that fat of a lead, who cares about solo bombs? They don't do any damage. Nothing hurt. There's a reason why the Rays are 35-0 when they lead after 7 innings. There's a reason why the Rays have the best record in the American League. They didn't just show up to get speed bagged by the Dodgers. Nor do they care that they were matching up with not only the best team in baseball, but a team that many consider the best Dodgers team ever. They don't care about that. They don't care about that, nor the fact that the Dodgers and their fans are looking to exercise 32 years worth of demons. And on that note, I don't know what's more insane, that the LA Dodgers have gone 32 years between world championships, or that Kirk Gibson hit that bomb 32 years ago. I mean, dude, speaking of somebody kicking somebody else's ass, Father Time is kicking all of our asses. That really happened 32 years ago. Anyway, here's the thing for the Dodgers. At some point, Tony Gonsolin and Dustin May are going to have to get it going. They're going to have to get something from these guys. There's a reason why Dave Roberts keeps running them out there in big spots. These two were incredible during the regular season. And there's a reason why every time he turns to them right now, it seems like the Dodgers are outthinking themselves. Because neither one of these guys has been big in big spots. In fact, I hate to say it, both these guys have been really bad in big spots. Gonsolin had a 2.31 ERA with 46 strikeouts and 32 hits allowed in 46 innings in the regular season. This guy was averaging a strikeout per. That's a weapon. In the postseason, he's got an ERA of over 9, and now he's walking nearly one batter every inning. And that continued last night. He started, and while he only gave up one hit was that bomb in the first, and that set the tone for the entire evening. Then you got May. May's not much better. Again, during the regular season, this guy was an animal. He had an ERA of just over 2.5. In the postseason, his ERA is nearly double that. And then last night when he came in with one on and two out in the fourth, he dragged his gas can to the bump with him once again, promptly allowing a single and a double, and that drove in two. That turned a 1-0 game into a 3-0 game in about 1 second flat. Then he stuck around for the fifth, and he gave up Lau's second home run of the game. Hey, look, I get it. It's hard to go from being a starter to a guy in the bullpen to a starter and not knowing when you're going to go on a given night or in a given game. Like, I get that. But if the hope was that these guys were going to be super subs, if the hope was that these guys would be Swiss Army knives that could give LA whatever it needed in games that Clayton Kershaw and Walker Buehler weren't starting, then that's not happening. They've combined to allow 13 earned runs in less than 17 innings of postseason work. I mean, to hell with Swiss Army knives. These dudes are sporks. So, yes, I told you that this series was not over after one game. Don't act like it's over after one game because it's not. So there's an off day today, then three games in 3 days. If the Dodgers are smart, they'll do what got them there or stay with what got them there. They'll do what they do best. They'll grind at bats. They'll wear down the Rays starters. They'll try to tire out that bullpen. And then they're going to need their own bullpen to do some work as well. They've lined it up. Buehler, Urias, Kershaw in games 3, 4, and 5. But if the series goes longer than that, they're going to have to get something from Gonsolin and May at some point. These guys have to go back to dominating. In the very least, they have to eat some innings. They've got to give them something. But you can't come in and keep putting it on a tee for the Rays because they will just keep reversing it into the seats. So now you're back to square one. That lead in the series that felt so big and so fat after the Dodgers blasted the Rays in the first game, that's all gone now. First 1-3 wins, and now it's a best of five. And for anybody who rushed in after that first game to say it's going to be a really short series, you should have known better. I did. That's why I told you it was not going to go like that. I'm going to stick with the Dodgers in seven, like I said before the series started. But I'm going to need Gonsolin and May to start doing their jobs. Look, I'm not looking to make it about me. I'm not. I'm going to make it about those two. Do better, fellas. Do better. Do your jobs. I know a number of you listening are business owners. If you are, you do not need to tell us that running a business is tough. It is really tough. But you might be making it tougher on yourself than it has to be. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down any longer. It is time for you to upgrade. Upgrade to NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that do not give you the information you need when you need it. Get rid of the spreadsheets and all that old software. Get rid of the spreadsheets and all the old software that's bogging you down that you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need, and it's all in one place, and you get it instantaneously. So whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue. Save time and money with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies that are using NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Rome. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Rome. Once again, netsuite.com/ROME. Talk about Odell Beckham Jr. for a minute. He was in the news yesterday on two separate topics. Neither of them is what it appears. Why don't we start with LSU? LSU is going with self-imposed penalties relating to an NCAA investigation into improper booster payments to football players. Sports Illustrated reported that LSU is going to lose 8 scholarships over 2 years and that they're going to reduce recruiting visits because of the payments from boosters to football players. And just about every single headline that related to that story led with the fact that Odell Beckham Jr. has been banned from the facility for 2 years. Almost every single story led with that in the headline. So if you saw that, you would think that all of this is connected to Beckham doling out cash to LSU players after the national championship game this year. And then probably you're going to crush him for being so dumb and so stupid to get his own program into trouble like that. Like, how could he not know better, right? Except Beckham is not the problem here. The $2,000 that he handed out in a moment of jubilation was couch cushion money compared to what John Paul Funes did. Now, this dude is something else. Not Beckham, but Funes. Check this guy's act. Funes embezzled nearly $800,000 from a hospital over a 7-year period. Let me repeat that. He stole $800,000 from a hospital. That's bad. And it's about to get much worse. Let me read you this summary from theadvocate.com. Quote, Funes had admitted stealing gift cards meant for cancer patients, flying family and friends to LSU and New Orleans Saints football games on charter flights labeled as outbound patient transports, and sending money to people who did little to no work for the Our Lady of the Lake Foundation. And one of the people who did little to no work for that foundation was the father of an LSU player, and that father was paid $100,000 for a no-show job. So to recap, this guy stole nearly $800,000 from a hospital, including stealing gift cards that were meant for cancer patients. He stole them. He chartered flights to LSU games and Saints games under the guise of transporting patients, and he gave $180,000 that was supposed to be for the hospital to the parent of an LSU football player. And for all of this, this guy gets 33 months in federal prison. Except the headline, almost every single headline, was not about that guy, but rather Odell Beckham. Because Odell Beckham gave a few $100 to a few players. Yeah, because that makes so much sense. Because that makes total and complete sense. Because Odell Beckham Jr. is the bad guy here. Not the guy who stole $800,000 from a hospital and gift cards that were supposed to be for cancer patients. You know, and that's before we even kick over the hornet's nest that is not allowing college athletes to receive compensation. But folks are still rushing in to make Odell look like the bad guy here, when he's not. Far from it. And that's not the only thing that involved him yesterday. It was not just the LSU situation that had Odell Beckham Jr. in the news. It was the COVID situation. Because if you were online at any point in the last 24 hours, you probably read or heard this quote from Beckham. Quote, not in an arrogant way. I just don't think COVID can get to me. I don't think it's going to enter this body. I don't want no part of it. It don't want no parts of me. I think it's a mutual respect. End quote. And then again, mostly because of who we're talking about, everybody starts to crack on Beckham for saying that COVID didn't want any part of him and that there was, quote, a mutual respect between him and the virus. You know, kind of like the virus and Beckham saw each other walking down the street. They stopped. They looked at each other. They measured each other. They thought about squaring up and then nodded to each other and kept right on moving. You know, like the virus looked at Odell, kind of, you know, looked him up and down, kind of gave him a little wave, kind of tipped his cap, you know, kind of like game respecting game. Which is funny because, of course, the virus does not respect anybody or anything. The virus is the most disrespectful thing in the world. The virus does not give a damn about who you are, how much you make, how famous you are, how big and badass you are. If you give it a chance, the virus will run up the score on you any day at all. It's not putting in the backups with a big lead. The virus is out there running fake field goals and fake punts up 50. The virus does not give a damn. There is no code when it comes to the virus. The virus will dunk on you and hang on the rim. The virus will hit it 500 feet, flip the bat, walk around the bases backwards. The virus will start high-stepping at midfield until it gets into the end zone if it wants to. So the very moment that excerpt came out from Beckham, people were looking to kill Beckham. But if you listen to the entire version, the fuller version of the quote, and if you're listening, note that he starts to crack a smile when he first answers the question.
No, not in an arrogant way. I just don't think COVID can get to me. I don't think it's going to enter this body. I don't want no parts of it. It don't want no parts of me. I think it's a mutual respect. So I wasn't really worried about the test. I was just more, you know, in my mind, for me and my maturity level, I felt like it was the right thing to do to mention. I may not have been feeling well. I just wouldn't want it to spread throughout the whole building. If there was a case that I would have possibly had it, I was just trying to be an adult and be precautious about the situation and try and handle it the right way.
Right. So when you hear that thing in its entirety, it's totally different. He's talking about how he respects the virus. He's talking about the precautions that he took surrounding the virus, which is excellent. This is what everybody should be doing. This is not something you want to mess with. And this all came about because Beckham said that he was not feeling that well last week. So he did the right thing. He spoke up. He told somebody. As a result, he had to miss 2 days of practice because that's the protocol. And he did the right thing. And for that, the guy should be praised. The guy should actually be celebrated, not mocked. He didn't do that fake bullcrap macho thing of trying to hide the symptoms or lie about the symptoms, because that's how you get an outbreak. He didn't do that thing that happens in every single movie involving a virus where somebody gets the virus through a mosquito bite or a mosquito circumcision or the air or whatever. And then that person shows up pale and sweating and looking like crap, but pretends to be fine. And then everybody gets sick. Like, Beckham is actually a role model for other players on this. If you're feeling sick, you don't fight through it and possibly trigger an outbreak that risks the entire team or puts the entire team at risk. You do the right thing. You speak out. And you think that guy wanted to miss practice. You think that guy wanted to miss any time at all. Of course not. But he did the right thing. You protect yourself, and then you protect everybody around you by doing the right thing.
But that's just what we have set up for this year. That's what they seem to have voted on and did all these phone calls and everything to come up with whatever the game plan is going to be. So like Coach said, just embrace the suck. It is what it is. It's just part of the 2020 season.
The guy didn't want to do it. Believe me. He much rather would have kept his mouth shut and gone to work. But he knew that, hey, if I've got this thing, then I'm going to put others at risk. I can't do that. Embrace the suck. It is just part of the 2020 season. So no, Beckham does not deserve the heat that he's getting for these two things. Does not deserve the blame that he's getting for LSU. He wasn't the problem there. And does not deserve all the heat he's getting with respect for COVID. In fact, he deserves a lot more respect for his respect for COVID. He handled that thing the right way. But because it's Beckham, people want to rush in and kill the guy. You can watch Carlos Peña as part of MLB Network's World Series coverage. It's airing before and after every game from Globe Life Field. He joins us right now, Carlos Peña. Carlos, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, man, really pumped to be joining you this afternoon. So thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and I'm pumped to have you, too. So going into the series, you would compare this Rays team to the team in 2008 that you were a part of. Can you take me back to 08 first? What made that team so special?
Well, I think we have to go immediately to the history of the franchise at that time, you know, and their young history, really. It was a 10-year losing story. I mean, you think about the fact that first 10 years in the organization, they had never won 60 games. 60! And 2007, that was actually my best year as far as individual stats are concerned. Just a year after, we become what they called us the Beast of the East and arguably the best team in the American League in just a year of a turnaround. I think that's what makes the story so remarkable. And dethroning just these perennial teams that had just continually been to the World Series and the postseason in the Yankees and the Red Sox. So that's what I think the biggest story of it all was, the fact that we went to the World Series after never, ever in the history of the franchise winning 60 games. That is remarkable.
It is. Carlos Pena joining us. That really was remarkable. And that 08 team had established MLB stars, guys like you, Cliff Floyd, Carl Crawford. And that's before we get into the crazy young talent that you guys had on that roster as well. What about this 2020 team? Do they have as many guys who are as established as stars as that group did?
Yeah, not at all. That's, I think, what makes this team very unique and peculiar is the fact that you could argue back in 2007 and going on 2008 that, okay, we didn't have these superstar, you know, high-priced talent, but we had quite a few established big leaguers, you know, in myself, Cliff Floyd, Carl Crawford, pretty good players. And, you know, you could say, even argue that we were stars in some regard. But this ball club right here, it's just a bunch of good, solid players. It's not to take away from any of them. But in reality, you don't have that one that stands out and says, oh, that's a bona fide superstar in the big leagues. You cannot find one in that ball club that you could say that about. And that's what makes this team really interesting. But also, I believe that that is precisely why they are so dangerous. It's because they're used to playing that type of baseball where everyone has to contribute and nothing falls on any particular player fully. It's the sum of all parts that makes this ball club very dangerous.
We are talking to Carlos Pena. All right, so Carlos, things did not go so well for the Rays in game one. Clayton Kershaw got through that first inning that was kind of rough, and then he settled in, and then he was rolling. Then the Dodger hitters did their damage. So what do you make of how Tampa Bay played in game one and then how they responded in game two?
You know, game one was sloppy. I thought that Glasnow was all over the place with the placement of his fastball. I thought it was too random the way he was utilizing speed. When, if you asked me, I would have had him throw the fastball pretty much precisely up and in and pound these Dodgers hitters in with the fastball and elevated, not just in, elevated. That would have made his off-speed pitches a lot more effective. That didn't happen. And I thought they came out flat. The bats were not on cue. And look, I'm going to give Kershaw quite a lot of credit. I mean, it was a tough first inning, but then he made the adjustment. I thought he was flying open early on in the game, and then he was able to close off and utilize that front shoulder almost as a hinge. And you saw the bite and the slider come back. The fastball location was where a little bit better. And obviously that just carried the Dodgers to a win. The offense was locked in for the Dodgers as well. The good thing was that the Rays came back immediately. You know, I thought last night was a must win for the Rays. If the Rays would have found themselves two games behind the Dodgers at this point, you could have said it was pretty much a wrap, in my opinion. So for the Rays to be able to punch back and kind of say, hey, back off of me, I'm not going to be cornered, you know, it's so important. And now they're sitting looking forward to practically a best of five series with pretty much the entire setup as far as the pitching is concerned. You know, with this rest day here, Cash has a lot of options. So this is best case scenario for the Rays after the way the game one went.
See, what, I'm glad you said that. I could not agree with you more.
Well, right now.
That was a must-win game. Excuse me, Carlos. I'm glad you said it, because when you've got Blake Snell on the mound and the Dodgers are going with Tony Gonsolin and followed by a bunch of relievers and they've lost game one, they had to win that game. To me, that definitely was a must-win game. What was your reaction when Brandon Lau went deep in the first inning? And then how big of a moment was that for the Rays, not just in the game, but in the entire series?
Jim, that's absolutely huge, because Brandon, it's one of those pillars in that lineup, and he had not been performing. You know, let's just be quite honest. He's been struggling during the postseason. And a lot of times, you know, when we look at hitters, we start thinking, oh, what's wrong with his swing? Well, let me tell you that usually what we're looking at is symptoms. You know, when we see swings break down, it's not because the swing itself is wrong. It's because the timing is wrong. So we got to go to the root of the problem. And I thought he made a great adjustment yesterday at getting ready earlier. He's been late on fastballs, fouling pitches off, even though you're like, wow, I was right on that fastball. I just missed it. No, you were late. You were a few degrees late, a few clicks late. And I thought he did a better job of getting ready early enough to catch up to those fastballs. Yes, they were out over the plate. So, you know, pitchers did not locate the way they should have. But the swing was so crisp and smooth and natural. And look, let's talk about what it does to the ball club to see their best hitter, you know, arguably, perform. I mean, it is absolute a huge boost for the ball club, for the offense, and now they're sitting with confidence that they can go forward and really compete with this very potent lineup that the Dodgers have.
Carlos Pena is joining us. All right, so what about Randy Rosarena? When you watch him play and the way he's broken out this postseason, I mean, like, Carlos, the ball just explodes off this guy's bat. As one hitter watching another, what sticks out to you the most in terms of how he's able to barrel up the ball consistently?
Jim, I'm going to dive in a little bit deeper, you know, as far as hitting is concerned. I think sometimes we look at, you know, like, oh, hand-and-eye coordination, you know. And yes, we do need hand-and-eye coordination to be great hitters in the big league level. But I'm not concerned about hitters in the big leagues actually intersecting the pitch line. You know, that's always done. The key is to actually do it at the right time. That's why hitters, when they have that loopy swing, it's very difficult to make contact, because if you're not on time, you're swinging and missing. All right. Well, Randy Rosarena is one of these guys that have a very, very flat swing. So he's got two things going for himself. He is on the pitch line for a very, very, very long time, more than most. So forget about swinging up. I don't believe in that launch angle thing. If you are thinking about it in terms of swinging up, launch angle happens after you hit the baseball, all right? And Rosarena gets on the pitch line immediately. So that gives him a lot of margin for error. Now, if you add to that very good timing, then the production just comes. It is just exactly what happens when you have that perfect formula. And Randy Rosarena has been doing precisely that, on the path, online with the pitch, and on time. That is the perfect formula for success and as an offensive player and as a hitter.
I'm glad you went deep on that. Carlos Pena joining us. All right, so Carlos, Tampa Bay is famous also in the way they handle their bullpen, and they're not afraid to shake up their lineup either. In the past, a lot of relievers would prefer to have a specific role, either as a setup man or a specialist or a closer. The Rays, of course, do not take that approach. How has Kevin Cash and the rest of the organization gotten everybody to buy in and be prepared to deliver no matter what role they're given?
And I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I think traditionally we've seen guys who, hey, man, I want to make sure I get to the park and I'm hitting fourth. You know, I'm cleanup. I don't even look at the lineup. I know where I'm hitting. That used to be the narrative. And then people and players, you know, used to always say that that's what they would prefer. But here we are in a totally different style of play. I think we can say that about both ball clubs. You mentioned the different lineups, 59 different lineups for the Rays during the regular season, 57 for the Dodgers. They have the same style of play, even though the money they spend is totally different. I mean, it's lopsided in that regard. But Cash has done a great job of communicating to players the importance of everyone just contributing. And it's remarkable to me, so important to me, to see how everyone has bought in. In essence, if you are a pitcher for the Tampa Bay Rays, you are not designed any specific role. Your job is to put out fires or to prevent the house from getting on fire. All right, that is your role. It is very ambiguous, which means that at any moment, you could be called upon to put out a fire or preventing the house from getting on fire. That is the mentality of the entire pitching staff. And if you are a hitter, you're there to do damage. You're there to go on a search and destroy mission. Where? You know, where, what, who, what is the target? It doesn't matter to you. You're ready to be deployed. And if I'm allowed, you know, with all respect, you know, to talk in military terms, I'm just ready to be deployed whenever. I don't know what my job is. I'm looking for my target, and I'm going to destroy it. And that's your job as a hitter, regardless whether you're hitting leadoff, cleanup, or last. It does not matter.
I love that analogy always, man. Targets. Targets. Just knock down your targets. Find your target. Lock it on the target. So, Carlos, what if you're an opposing hitter? How much does your approach to the game change when you know you're going to see a different pitcher every single time you step to the plate?
Well, it should change, right? It should change, Jim. But unfortunately, I would say, as I look at hitters, they're behind in that sense because they are not preparing to hunt the pitcher. So, in other words, you can go in an 162 game season and pretty much set parameters, you know, as far as variables are concerned. I'm going to get deep again into hitting, but and this is the thing. I've had experience, so I'm talking about the application, but also now that I'm retired and just solely studying this, I also have the theory and the science behind it to match what I'm talking about. If you just set parameters and basically you say, I'm just going to look away, react in, and that's your approach during the World Series, a short series, you know, you may never get that pitch within the parameters that you've set. In the 162-game season, you will get some pitches in that area enough to put up pretty decent numbers. But in a short series, you better get out there and hunt the pitcher that's on the mound. How? You have to know what they throw. You have to know what pitch they go to. And you have to sit on these pitches. And not only that, be ready for the speed of those pitches so that your timing is on par for those. That's how you defeat, you know, these really tough pitchers on both sides, really. I mean, because both teams have great, great pitching. You can't just go up there and default guys, you know, especially in the postseason and these short series. You have to have a plan and a strategy. And it better change. You have to sit on pitches. You cannot try to hit everything, cover the whole entire strike zone. You want to be the master of one pitch instead of being, I would say, trying to be, you know, cover everything, which you will not be able to do. All right, so it's very key to come up with a very specific strategy.
All right, so now, Carlos, you just said that in retirement now you have a chance that even though you've had the experience and the application, you can study this more. But it seems to me you're still doing some hunting, a different kind of hunting. For instance, you still killed for MLB Network, but I want to ask you about some of the work you did in the ALCS. You were on that demo field. You're charging ground balls. You're showing how a first baseman should be stretching. You're doing it all in a suit with the suit jacket buttoned up, and you're making it look really smooth. Almost anybody else would have taken off their jacket, maybe blown out the pants or the jacket buttons trying to run and stretch. Man, exactly how did you do all that?
Hilarious. You know, I always worried about splitting the suit, you know, because I try to wear the fitted, nice fitted suits. You know what I'm talking about, Jim?
Oh, I do.
Like, you know, the Italian nice fitted suit. But, man, I just think it's so important, and I'm very passionate about taking the fans into the game and explaining what's truly happening. And Jim, I hate cliches, man. I just hate giving the fans cliches. I want to make sure that I bring substance. So if that means that I have to go ahead and field ground balls with my suit or take some swings with my suit, that's precisely what I'm going to do.
No, and I love that. And you want to make sure that the suit looks good and feels good. So, Carlos, how have you approached it in retirement in terms of working out, maintaining good physical conditioning, nutrition? Did you kind of take the foot off the gas, or do you still live that lifestyle? Because it looks like you do.
Jim, my wife jokes with me all the time. It's like, you're working out harder than you did when you played.
Right.
And that is true to an extent, because when I played, I had to be a little bit more careful because injury was always something that we were trying to prevent. Now I can go a little bit more aggressive. So I'm lifting heavier weight than I ever have, you know, lifted. You know, I'm hitting max, you know, maxing out on the bench press, for example. We never bench press when we played. It was just one of those things that we try to stay away from because of the shoulder health and all that. So I'm going harder than ever before. I'm glad you noticed, and that actually motivates me she'll keep on doing it.
So, Carlos, yeah, exactly. I get that. So let me ask you this then. Why? I mean, do you love it or do you love what it does for you? Why are you going as hard as you are right now?
Man, I think I missed the competition. And now the competition that is, you know, I can't do it on the field, I do it against myself. It's basically saying, hey, what can you conquer next? You know, what is it? What kind of move can you conquer next? How much weight can you push next? You know, how many pull-ups can you do? And I'm like, well, you wouldn't be able to do that when you were 25, and now at 42, you're doing it? Okay, that's impressive. So I feel like it's a constant trying to push myself to the limit. I absolutely love it. You know, so I love sports, I love fitness and all that. And I think I'm you know, self-disciplined. There's a quote. Someone asked me, like, can you give me a quote? Can you give me a quote to put in the gym, the gym that I go to here, on a club next door? And, the quote was, success is built upon self-discipline. So self-discipline to me has always been key to anything I do. Ever since I was young, it was crazy. I had that in my mind. I think it was instilled by, you know, by my parents, instilled in me by my parents, and I still live by that motto. So if I ever want to reach new heights, I have to be self-disciplined. So that's why I work out so hard still, Jim.
I absolutely love it. I love the message. Carlos Pena, my guest. Carlos, one last thought, and I've kept you longer than I do any other guest, but I so appreciate the energy and the insight both. The Dodgers have been so good at extending at-bats and even extending innings. With all the runs they've scored with two outs, that is, what kind of a psychological toll does that take on the opposing team when they're extending at-bats and extending innings?
So it's most definitely a factor. As a matter of fact, I'm going to even go back a little bit. One of my concerns with the Rays was the fact that they had a very strenuous, emotionally strenuous series with the Astros. You know, after being three games up and then having to almost, you know, lost the lead and pretty much almost lost the World Series, and they had to come out, the ALCS, and had to come out and win that game seven, that takes a toll on you. So I was worried about them coming out flat. I thought they came out flat, game one in the World Series. The same token, when you have hitters just put up a fight every single AB, it takes so much out of you. It drains you. So there's a lot to be said about the resilience of this Dodger lineup, that pitchers cannot take at-bats off. And this is the thing, Jim. They have to be very economical and frugal with their pitch counts. So you can't have, you know, you can't go 3-2 in every single batter. That's going to be totally deplete your arsenal there in the bullpen and in your arms. So you have to be efficient with the way you pitch and the sequencing of your pitches. So that's something to watch out for here as we go forward. And deeper into the World Series.
Could not love that conversation any more than I do. He's a 14-year MLB vet, an all-star, a gold glove winner, a silver slugger, an AL home run champion, an AL comeback player of the year award winner as well. And you can watch Carlos Pena as part of MLB Network's World Series coverage, which is airing before and after every game from Globe Life Field. Carlos, that was awesome. Appreciate you so much. Thank you for doing that.
Jim, it's always a pleasure. Let's make sure we do it again before the World Series is over.
I would love to. Hey, listen, did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? October is, in fact, Fire Prevention Month, and we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you get ready for the unexpected and review some key safety tips. Smoke and carbon monoxide alarms help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. And having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the very best things that you can do for your family. What you want to do is make sure you install alarms on every single level and in every single bedroom of your home. Once the alarms are installed, it is important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Remember, alarms do not last forever. They do need to be replaced every 10 years. If you can't remember the last time that you replaced yours, it is best just to replace that unit completely. And my favorite replacement option is the First Alert Combination Smoke and Carbon Monoxide Alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. This alarm provides 2-in-1 protection against smoke and carbon monoxide both. And I don't even have to change the batteries for a decade. I love that. Also, remember, take this time and discuss home safety with your family. plan, and practice an escape route, and remember to practice that at least twice a year. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, just go to firstalert.com/fireprevention month. I've done this with my family. We continue to do so. You should too. He is Ariel Helwani. Ariel, what's up? How are you?
Jim, a pleasure as always. Why do you say still a friend of the program? Was that ever in doubt?
In the event that anybody forgot or didn't know, or I want to emphasize the point. Still a friend. Long has been a friend. Always will be a friend.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot, considering I used to listen to you while driving with my mom in Montreal, and she used to love your long and dramatic pauses. So it's still an honor, and it's still surreal that you have me on the show. So thank you once again.
You got it. It's good to have you, and I appreciate the relationship. All right, so we're about 48 hours away from UFC 254. Habib Gaethje, you've been around the sport a long time. Where does this fight stack up among the all-time great fights in UFC history?
On paper, it's a fascinating one. It's certainly intriguing. You know, sometimes we are prisoners of the moment, and we say this is the best and that's the best. But when you consider the fact that Habib is 28-0. When you consider how dominant he's been, that he's only lost one round in the UFC to Conor McGregor a couple of years ago, and how good he's looked as a champion, how good he looked in his last fight against Dustin Poirier 13 months ago, and also you consider what he's been through this year, most notably the loss of his father, Abdulmanap, who wasn't just his father, was his mentor and best friend and head coach, all those things and more. And then when you consider Justin Gaethje and how good he has looked, and I believe Habib's toughest fight in the UFC, considering his skill set, the fact that he's a great wrestler, a tremendous striker, a very powerful striker. Yeah, this has all the makings. And oh, by the way, on top of all that, Habib is telling us like, hey, I might have one or two left, max. And so you start to think like, whoa, this is ending already? And you start to appreciate it more, and it all feels like a bigger deal. He fights essentially once a year these days, and distance makes the heart grow fonder. Now, all of a sudden, every time he reemerges, it feels like a bigger and bigger deal.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. And Ariel, you mentioned the loss of his father. Do you have any kind of sense, and I want to say this respectfully, but do you have any sense as to where he is emotionally and psychologically following the death of his father, who was also his best friend, his mentor, and his coach?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. And I know that it is, you know, this is part of our job, right? Like, we all remember Brett Favre playing, what was it, like 24 hours after his father passed away on Monday Night Football. Like, this is just a part of sports. Athletes are humans and all this stuff. It does feel a little uncomfortable that, like, his father gets used sometimes as a storyline, but I understand why that's happening. I'll just say this. To me, and from talking to people close to him and from just kind of observing him, it does feel like he is very determined and very motivated to do this for his father. Now, if you're wondering how it will affect him, like as far as X's and O's on Saturday, his father was actually only in his corner for one UFC fight. He had a visa issue, and the last time he was in his corner, the only time he was in his corner, was last September. His most recent fight in Abu Dhabi, he was able to travel from Dagestan to Abu Dhabi, but he couldn't get into the States. And so he's kind of used to fighting without his dad, but obviously this is much different. He's not, you know, he's not here anymore, unfortunately. And so, yeah, I'm curious. I was wondering if he'd come back. I was wondering if he'd say, I don't want to do this. But now it feels like he wants to do this in honor of his dad. And that's a very powerful thing. And they had a deal that he would make it to 30-0 and that maybe he would fight George St. Pierre in his last fight. And all these things are kind of coming to fruition. They're all within reach, I think. And so I think that we're going to see a very determined, a focused Habib who's wanting to do this for his dad, as opposed to a weak Habib who's going to use the passing of his father as an excuse or a crutch.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. And then on the other side, you've got Gaethje, and he was just absolutely spectacular in showing up the way he did against Tony Ferguson. If he shows up that way, and again, we're talking about different guys, styles do make fights. If Gaethje shows up the way he did against Ferguson, how tough a fight will that be for Habib?
Very tough. And I'm happy that you said styles make fights, because at the end of the day, MMA, it's a very hard sport to predict, because this guy could look amazing against that guy, but then he fights the other guy who beat the guy that he looked amazing against, and then he loses to that guy. I mean, it's just,
right.
It's a crazy sport like that, right? MMA math can give you a big headache. And so I think, regardless of the matchup, if the Justin Gaethje who showed up against Ferguson, and by the way, the Justin Gaethje who showed up in the three fights prior to that shows up on Saturday, he has a very good chance because he's turned into a very different fighter than the one who lost two in a row a few years ago in the UFC. He used to be this Tasmanian devil who would walk in there and be okay with getting, you know, two punches to the chin and then handing out three. He liked the firefight. He liked fighting in that phone booth. He liked getting dropped. He was all like crazy for that sort of thing, fight of the night, all that stuff. Now he's become a lot more patient, a lot more calm, a lot more cool, collected, a lot smarter. He doesn't take the same kind of damage. And so I think if he can keep this fight in the center of the octagon, not get pressed up against the cage because that's where Khabib does his best work, not make this a dirty fight like that kind of fight where Khabib presses you up against the cage, takes you down, does the Dagestani handcuff routine, puts his hand over your mouth, what he did to Dustin Poirier. If he can keep it in the center of the octagon, utilize his leg kicks the same way he did against Tony Ferguson, keep him at bay, and then make this into a kickboxing fight, he's got better striking than Khabib. He has more power in his hands than Khabib. Remember, when Khabib fought Conor McGregor and Khabib took Conor down in the center of the octagon, not up against the cage, Conor got back up. And Justin has better takedown defense and better wrestling than Conor. So he'll be able to get back up, I think, as well. And then if he can keep this fight standing and tag Khabib, by the way, the same way Dustin Poirier tagged him in their fight last September, all bets are off. I really do think he has a chance if all those things can happen. Now, I know that's a big if, but I do think he has the skill set to make this into a really interesting fight.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. You know, both these guys also, Ariel, are really interesting personalities. I'm curious, what is your sense as to what each guy thinks of the other?
Total respect, no bad blood, no animosity. In fact, they're both managed by the same guy, a polarizing figure in our sport named Ali Abdelaziz. They're both managed by him. And so they're part of the same sort of team, if you will, family. But obviously, this is not a sparring match. They're going to beat each other. But one really cool thing that happened yesterday, and this has been what Gaethje has said ever since he beat Ferguson, he's not interested in the interim belt. You know, sometimes you'll see a guy win the interim belt or a woman win the interim belt and treat that as if it's the real belt. Heck, Conor McGregor did that. And he did a great job of almost like putting into existence the fact that he was the real champion, even though when he won the interim title against Chad Mendes back at UFC 189, he was the interim champion. He only became the official champ at UFC 194 when he knocked out Jose Aldo. Gaethje is one of those guys who won the interim belt and didn't even put it around his waist, put it on the ground and told Joe Rogan afterwards in May, hey, I'm waiting for the real one. Yesterday at the press conference when they faced off, they gave both of them a belt and Gaethje took it off and said, no, I'm waiting for that one. He's the real champ. I mean, how could you not respect that? How could you not love that? I know Khabib respects it, but I also know that Gaethje's been waiting for this moment a long time. He wants the real one. He's trying to go in and take it tomorrow. No, not tomorrow, Saturday. And by the way, we should remind everyone, I know it's a really busy Saturday, and I know it's Big Ten coming back and all that stuff, but this is an afternoon fight. This is a matinee, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific on ESPN Plus pay-per-view, and I'm not being Mr. Shill company businessman here. I just want the fans to know that this is happening in the afternoon so they don't miss it because it's worth obviously watching.
No, it's actually a very good point. I was going to bring that up. That's a 2 p.m. Eastern fight, 11 Pacific, and that speaks to the size of Khabib's international following, that they would do something like that. You mentioned Conor McGregor, Ariel. What about the fact that he agreed to fight Dustin Poirier on January 23rd and that he wants that fight to take place in Arlington at AT&T Stadium? Exactly where does that fight stand right now?
Well, right now it's not signed. They both kind of verbally agreed, but they haven't put pen to paper. And Dustin hasn't like officially agreed. I know he's kind of shown his hand a little bit on social media saying that he wants to fight, but they're still talking. I don't hate the fight. The fight is a good fight. If Conor wants to fight for the belt, if UFC wants to put him in a title fight, he should get by a Dustin Poirier. I don't like the fact that it's happening 3 months after Khabib Gaethje. A lot can happen in those 3 months. I think it would have made a lot more sense to have Conor fight in November so he could be fighting around the same time so that they can then come back before Ramadan next year, early April, have that fight. If it's Conor who wins, you do the Conor-Khabib rematch. If it's Gaethje who wins and Conor wins, you do Gaethje-Conor, which is a really big deal. All the possibilities are there. But now that you're having Conor fight 3 months later, I mean, there's a very good chance that, you know, if Khabib wins on Saturday and then Conor wins in January, we don't see the rematch until the fall of next year. And who knows what could happen between now and then. So that to me, look, the UFC won this public battle with Conor. I think it was like this game of one-upmanship, and everyone was trying to outdo the other. But the one part that they didn't win, in my opinion, was the date. I think the fight should have happened November 21st. You give the people what they want, and then you have Conor fighting around the same time as the title, because you always want to have the top contender fighting around the same time as the belt.
All right, so all that said, where or how would you describe the relationship now between Conor and the UFC?
Oh, and by the way, I didn't really answer your question. I do think right this second it happens in Vegas. They're not looking at Texas AT&T Stadium, I should say, Cowboy Stadium. But again, a lot can happen between now and then. The relationship between Conor and the UFC is in an interesting spot. You know, there's been this misconception over the years that they were all, like, tight and they were, you know, BFF, kumbaya. That hasn't been the case for the past four or so years. You know, the UFC, as you know, they are a very dominant brand, and they are led by a dominant ego, right? And that's been part of their success. And they don't like when someone gets bigger than the brand. And you can make a case that Conor is just as big as the brand. Like, you could walk down a street in, I don't know, Brussels and ask someone who Conor McGregor is. There's a chance they know who Conor is, but maybe they don't know who the UFC is. That hasn't been the case in the past. He recognizes that. They recognize that. And there's this constant battle to prove that they are, you know, the bosses, right? That they tell Conor what to do. And so that's why they say, all right, you're going to fight on this day. And he's like, no, I want to fight on this day. You're going to fight this guy. I want to fight that guy. Oh, we're going to agree to fight, but I want it to be at AT&T Stadium. Like, it's this constant game of back and forth. And so they're not, you know, the best of friends, but they always recognize at the end of the day that there's a lot of money to be made when they are on the same page. So we see this thing happen often. They battle, and then eventually they agree. This is what's happening again. But at some point, once Conor's deal expires, and I believe there's four fights left, things are going to get really interesting. Unless they somehow dramatically fix this relationship, I would say it's probably not trending in the right direction.
It's a fascinating conversation, right? Who has the bigger brand, the UFC or Conor in and of himself?
Who do you think?
He's a journalist for ESPN, the host of several shows and podcasts, etc. And yes, a friend of the program. And remember, Ariel makes a very good point. It is going to be a 2 p.m. Eastern time for the main card, 11 o'clock Pacific. And that's unusual, so make note of that. Ariel, great job. Have an amazing weekend. Great to talk to you about that fight, and I know we'll do it again soon.
And by the way, if you see Chael Sonnen, I haven't seen him or heard from him since I laid the verbal smackdown on him on your program a couple months ago. If you see or hear from him, tell him I'm looking for him. I'm concerned, and I hope he's doing okay.
Ariel, do you think one thing has anything to do with the other? Did you put him to sleep? Did you put him to sleep?
I haven't heard from him, so I would imagine he's either asleep or has just left out of fear for his own safety.
Let's get a phone call in here quickly. It is an open phone hour. We go to Tampa. Bill in Tampa. In other words, in market, on topic. What's going on, Bill? How are you?
Hey, doing pretty good, Jim. I appreciate you having me on. You pronounced Tampa wrong. That's Bill from Champa Bay. But I wanted to call and talk about them calling this World Series a neutral site. You know, I don't understand what's so neutral after the Dodgers have played, I guess, what, over 10 games, three series at this ballpark. They've been in the city. They've been playing in front of fans. And, you know, Tampa's been playing over there in California with a marine layer, playing games at 5 o'clock p.m. with the sun setting in their eyes. And, you know, I think it's going to be Tampa in six. But do you think the Dodgers have an advantage playing where they've been playing for the last three series?
All right, so let me respond to that. Bill in Tampa. First of all, Bill, what does it matter? Your team plays in Champa.
Good night now!